Chapter 10. But there was nothing improper in my observing to find that, last night, Mrs. Fine seemed to have some idea where that enterprising young lady had gone to. Fine shook his head. No, his wife had been by no means so certain as he had pretended to be. She merely had her reasons to think, to hope, that the girl might have taken a room somewhere in London, had buried herself in town in readiness, or perhaps in horror of the approaching day, he ceased and sat solemnly dejected, in a brown study. Had they? I asked at last, but he did not hear me apparently. He diffused such portentous gloom into the atmosphere, that I lost patience with him. What on earth are you so dismal about? I cried, being genuinely surprised and puzzled. Ye would think the girl was a state prisoner under your care. And suddenly I became still more surprised at myself, at the way I had somehow taken for granted things which did appear queer when one thought them out. But why this secrecy? Why did they elope, if it is an elopement? Was the girl afraid of your wife? And your brother-in-law? What on earth possesses him to make a clandestine match of it? Was he afraid of your wife too? Fine made an effort to rouse himself. Of course my brother-in-law, Captain Anthony, the son of... Dot, he checked himself, as if trying to break a bad habit. He would be persuaded by her. We have been most friendly to the girl. She struck me as a foolish and inconsiderate little person. But why should you and your wife take to heart so strongly mere folly, or even a want of consideration? It's the most unscrupulous action, declared Fine weightily and sighed. I suppose she is poor, I observed after a short silence. But after all, Dot, you don't know who she is. Fine had regained his average solemnity. I confessed that I had not caught her name when his wife had introduced us to each other. T was something beginning with an S, wasn't it? And then with the utmost coolness Fine remarked that it did not matter. The name was not her name. Do you mean to say that you made a young lady known to me under a false name? I asked, with the amused feeling that the days of wonders and portents had not passed away yet. That the eminently serious Fines should do such an exceptional thing was simply staggering. With a more hasty enunciation than usual, little Fine was sure that I would not demand an apology for this irregularity if I knew what her real name was. A sort of warmth crept into his deep tone. We have tried to befriend that girl in every way. She is the daughter and only child of DeBarrel. Evidently he expected to produce a sensation. He kept his eyes fixed upon me, prepared for some sign of it. But I merely returned his intense, awaiting gaze. For a time we stared at each other. Conscious of being reprehensibly dense, I groped in the darkness of my mind. DeBarrel, and all at once noise and light burst on me, as if a window of my memory had been suddenly flung open on a street in the city. DeBarrel. But could it be the same? Surely not. The financier? I suggested, half incredulous. Yes, said Fine, and in this instance his native solemnity of tone seemed to be strangely appropriate. He convict. Marlowe looked at me, significantly, and remarked in an explanatory tone. One somehow never thought of DeBarrel as having any children, or any other home than the offices of the RB, or any other existence, associations or interests than financial. I see you remember the crash. Dot, I was away in the Indian Seas at the time, I said. But of course, Marlowe struck in. LL the world. Dot, you may wonder at my slowness in recognizing the name. But you know that my memory is merely a mausoleum of proper names. There they lie inanimate, awaiting the magic touch, and not very prompt in arising when called either. The name is the first thing I forget of a man. It is but just to add that frequently it is also the last, and this accounts for my possession of a good many anonymous memories. In DeBarrel's case, he got put away in my mausoleum in company with so many names of his own creation that really he had to throw off a monstrous heap of grisly bones before he stood before me at the call of the wizard Fine. The fellow had a pretty fancy in names. The Orb Deposit Bank, the Scepter Mutual Aid Society, the Rifton Independence Association. Yes, a very pretty taste in names, and nothing else besides absolutely nothing, no other merit. Well, yes. He had another name, but that's pure luck, his own name of Debarl, which he did not invent. I don't think that a mere Jones or Brown could have fished out from the depths of the incredible such a colossal manifestation of human folly as that man did. But it may be that I am underestimating the alacrity of human folly in rising to the bait. No doubt I am. The greed of that absurd monster is incalculable, unfathomable, inconceivable. The career of Debarl demonstrates that it will rise to a naked hook. He didn't lure it with a fairy tale. He hadn't enough imagination for it. Dot, was he a foreigner? I asked. T's clearly a French name. I suppose it was his name? Oh, he didn't invent it. He was born to it, in Bethnal Green, as it came out during the proceedings. He was in the habit of alluding to his Scotch connections. But every great man has done that. The mother, I believe, was Scotch, right enough. The father, Debarl, whatever his origins, retired from the customs service, tied waiter I think, and started lending money in a very, very small way in the East End to people connected with the docks, stevedores, minor barge owners, ship chandlers, tally clerks, all sorts of very small fry. He made his living at it. He was a very decent man, I believe. He had enough influence to place his only son as junior clerk in the account department of one of the dock companies. Ah, my boy, he said to him, I've given you a fine start. But Debarl didn't start. He stuck. He gave perfect satisfaction. At the end of 3 years he got a small rise of salary and went out courting in the evenings. He went courting the daughter of an old sea captain who was a churchwarden of his parish, and lived in an old badly preserved Georgian house with a garden. One of these houses standing in a reduced bit of grounds that you discover in the labyrinth of the most sordid streets, exactly alike and composed of six-roomed hutches. Some of them were the vicarages of slum parishes. The old sailor had got hold of one cheap, and Debarl got hold of his daughter, which was a good bargain for him. The old sailor was very good to the young couple, and very fond of their little girl. Mrs. Debarl was an equable and assuming woman, at that time with a fund of simple gaiety, and with no ambitions. But, womanlike, she longed for change and for something interesting to happen now and then. It was she who encouraged Debarl to accept the offer of a post in the West End branch of a great bank. It appears he shrank from such a great adventure for a long time. At last his wife's arguments prevailed. Later on she used to say, it's the only time he ever listened to me, and I wonder now if it hadn't been better for me to die before I ever made him go into that bank. ... You may be surprised at my knowledge of these details. Well, I had them ultimately from Mrs. Fine. Mrs. Fine, while yet Miss Anthony, in her days of bondage, knew Mrs. Debarl in her days of exile. Mrs. Debarl was living then in a big stone mansion with mullioned windows, in a large damp park, called the Priory, adjoining the village where the refined poet had built himself a house. These were the days of Debarl's success. He had bought the place without ever seeing it, and had packed off his wife and child at once there to take possession. He did not know what to do with them in London. He himself had a suite of rooms in an hotel. He gave their dinner parties followed by cards in the evening. He had developed the gambling passion, or else a mere card mania, but at any rate he played heavily, for relaxation, with a lot of dubious hangers-on. Meantime Mrs. Debarl, expecting him every day, lived at the Priory, with a carriage and pair, a governess for the child and many servants. The village people would see her through the railings wandering under the trees with her little girl lost in her strange surroundings. Nobody ever came near her. And there she died as some faithful and delicate animals die from neglect, absolutely from neglect, rather unexpectedly and without any fuss. The village was sorry for her because, though obviously worried about something, she was good to the poor, and was always ready for a chat with any of the humble folks. Of course they knew that she wasn't a lady, not what you would call a real lady. And even her acquaintance with Miss Anthony was only a cottage door, a village street acquaintance. Carleon Anthony was a tremendous aristocrat. His father had been a restoring architect, and his daughter was not allowed to associate with anyone but the county young ladies. Nevertheless, in defiance of the poet's wrathful concern for undefiled refinement, there were some quiet, melancholy strolls to and fro in the great avenue of chestnuts leading to the park gate, during which Mrs. DeBarrel came to call Miss Anthony my dear, and even my poor dear. The lonely soul had no one to talk to, but the not very happy girl. The governess despised her. The housekeeper was distant in her manner. Moreover, Mrs. DeBarrel was no foolish gossiping woman. But she made some confidences to Miss Anthony. Such wealth was a terrific thing, to have thrust upon one, she affirmed. Once she went so far as to confess that she was dying with anxiety. Mr. DeBarrel, so she referred to him, had been an excellent husband and an exemplary father, but, you see, my dear, I have had a great experience of him. I am sure he won't know what to do with all that money people are giving to him to take care of for them. He's as likely as not to do something rash. When he comes here, I must have a good long serious talk with him, like the talks we often used to have together in the good old times of our life. And then one day a cry of anguish was wrung from her. My dear, he will never come here, he will never, never come. She was wrong. He came to the funeral, was extremely cut up, and holding the child tightly by the hand wept bitterly at the side of the grave. Miss Anthony, at the cost of a whole week of sneers and abuse from the poet, saw it all with her own eyes. DeBarrel clung to the child like a drowning man. He managed, though, to catch the 5:30 fast train, traveling to town alone in a reserved compartment, with all the blinds down. Dot, leaving the child? I said interrogatively. Yes. Leaving. Dot, he shirked the problem. He was born that way. He had no idea what to do with her, or for that matter with anything or anybody including himself. He bolted back to his suite of rooms in the hotel. He was the most helpless. She might have been left in the priory to the end of time had not the high-toned governess threatened to send in her resignation. She didn't care for the child a bit, and the lonely, gloomy priory had got on her nerves. She wasn't going to put up with such a life, and, having just come out of some ducal family, she bullied DeBarrel in a very lofty fashion. To pacify her, he took a splendidly furnished house in the most expensive part of Brighton for them, and now and then ran down for a weekend, with a trunk full of exquisite sweets, and with his hat full of money. The governess spent it for him in extra ducal style. She was nearly 40, and harbored a secret taste for patronizing young men of sorts of a certain sort. But of that Mrs. Fine of course had no personal knowledge then. She told me, however, that even in the priory days he had suspected her of being an artificial, heartless, vulgar-minded woman with the lowest possible ideals. But DeBarrel did not know it. He literally did not know anything. But tell me, Marlowe, I interrupted, how do you account for this opinion? He must have been a personality in a sense, in some one sense, surely. You don't work the greatest material havoc of a decade at least, in a commercial community, without having something in you. Marlowe shook his head. He was a mere sign, a portent. There was nothing in him. Just about that time the word thrift was to the fore. You know the power of words. We pass through periods dominated by this or that word. It may be development, or it may be competition, or education, or purity or efficiency or even sanctity. It is the word of the time. Well, just then it was the word thrift which was out in the streets walking arm in arm with righteousness, the inseparable companion and backer up of all such national catchwords, looking everybody in the eye as it were. The very drabs of the pavement, poor things, didn't escape the fascination. However, the greatest portion of the press were screeching in all possible tones, like a confounded company of parrots instructed by some devil with a taste for practical jokes, that the financier de Barrel was helping the great moral evolution of our character towards the newly discovered virtue of thrift. He was helping it by all these great establishments of his, which made the moral merits of thrift manifest to the most callous hearts, simply by promising to pay 10% interest on all deposits. And you didn't want necessarily to belong to the well, to do classes in order to participate in the advantages of virtue. If you had but a spare sixpence in the world, and went and gave it to the Barrel, it was thrift. It's quite likely that he himself believed it. He must have. It's inconceivable that he alone should stand out against the infatuation of the whole world. He hadn't enough intelligence for that. But to look at him, one couldn't tell. Dot, you did see him then? I said with some curiosity. I did. Strange, isn't it? It was only once, but as I sat with the distressed fine who had suddenly resuscitated his name buried in my memory with other dead labels of the past, I may say I saw him again. I saw him with great vividness of recollection, as he appeared in the days of his glory or splendor. No. Neither of these words will fit his success. There was never any glory or splendor about that figure. Well, let us say in the days when he was, according to the majority of the daily press, a financial force working for the improvement of the character of the people. I'll tell you how it came about. At that time I used to know a podgy, wealthy, bald little man having chambers in the Albany, a financier too, in his way, carrying out transactions of an intimate nature, and of no moral character. Mostly with young men of birth and expectations, though I dare say he didn't withhold his ministrations from elderly plebeians either. He was a true democrat. He would have done business, a sharp kind of business, with the devil himself. Everything was fly that came into his web. He received the applicants in an alert, jovial fashion which was quite surprising. It gave relief without giving too much confidence, which was just as well perhaps. His business was transacted in an apartment furnished like a drawing room, the walls hung with several brown, heavily framed, oil paintings. I don't know if they were good, but they were big, and with their elaborate, tarnished gilt frames had a melancholy dignity. The man himself sat at a shining, inlaid writing table which looked like a rare piece from a museum of art. His chair had a high, oval, carved back, upholstered in faded tapestry, and these objects made of the costly black Havana cigar, which he rolled incessantly from the middle to the left corner of his mouth and back again, an inexpressibly cheap and nasty object. I had to see him several times in the interest of a poor devil so unlucky that he didn't even have a more competent Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.